This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Let's get a snapshot of the local economy with Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner. And if we just look at housing prices, things look spectacular if you're selling a house anyway.
Well, that's right. Good morning, Dave. I think what a lot of people are going to be focused on is the year-over-year change in price. And it's really quite remarkable. In King County, for example, up over 23.5%. Up in Snohomish County, almost 33%. But I would caution everyone to take those numbers with a bit of a pinch of salt. And I say that because remember where we were last May. And so looking at year-over-year comparisons, quite frankly, for anything, is probably going to give you a overly optimistic view of the world.
I've been reading financial stories which are saying prepare yourself for a roaring economy. I mean, if the idea of the COVID emergency funds was to prevent a recession, it certainly did that. And I guess the concern now is that it might have overcorrected too far in the other direction, and we're expecting we'll get rampant inflation as a result. Where do you come down on that?
Do I expect to see certainly an aggressive growth period going forward this year and likely probably for most of next year? Yeah, I do. And a lot of it is not just the fact that the government was handing out money. We all know that they were. But we were not for a long period spending it. And also a lot of people that were working, I mean, a majority of the country, even through COVID-19, were still employed. Even those people weren't spending their money in the normal manner. So as we reopen, as we feel more comfortable going out, what are we going to do? We're going to go shopping. And with that, that is going to lead to higher inflation levels than we've seen, quite frankly, in the last three decades. But at the same time, I just don't see how we will end up in a similar situation. A lot of people try and conflate it with what happened in the 70s and early 80s. Yeah. It's a very, very different place now.
Yeah, well, my memories of the late 70s, early 80s is mortgage rates of 15%. You can assure me that's never happening again.
Oh, no, that is not. In fact, we peaked in October of 1982 at, believe it or not, 20%.
Wow.
If you include points. So no, that's not going to happen. But are we going to go through a period through this year of inflation well above that 2% mark that the Federal Reserve do like to kind of keep an eye on? But I think it's going to be temporary. I think we'll see a boost as we, again, feel more comfortable going out. But it's going to settle back down again once we get into 2022.
Okay, now the Puget Sound economy in particular, we have had a couple of shocks, like the incredible vanishing airplane company up there that seems to be, you know, shedding jobs. Tech, I guess, has been pretty strong, but we seem to have, I don't know, lost our mojo. And yet at the same time, I saw this statistic that in terms of foreign investment, we actually beat Manhattan.
Yes. I mean, I think a lot of people obviously look at Manhattan, what's been going on there in a lot of respects, both housing and opportunity and business and the like. To find out that we top them is certainly a good thing. But you're right. I mean, if they lose your mojo, well, without a doubt, we are still being weighed down by aerospace. I mean, that's just an obvious statement. So when we look at the growth, so think about it, the Puget Sound region, let's just say the metro area, King and Snohomish counties, we lost over 216,000 jobs.
Wow.
Due to COVID-19. And we've got back, the latest data I've got is through April, about 103,000 of them. So we're still down by about 113,000 jobs in total. But at the same time, we've seen a full recovery in construction employment. They've actually got all the jobs back they lost and some. You mentioned information technology sector. That really was negligibly impacted, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. That has got all their jobs back as well. It's really bifurcated. But without a doubt, even though we've seen positive growth in construction, information, and most of these sectors are recovering, we're still being weighed down a lot, without a doubt, by leisure and hospitality.
Yeah,
I mean, that we lost, 79,000 jobs. We've only got 29,000 back. So that's a big issue. To say we lose our mojo, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. However, it certainly is unbalanced at the moment.
I think I asked you about the convention center before, but I every time I pass by that expansion, I wonder, is that thing ever going to be booked? given the reluctance of people to gather in large crowds. I mean, in a few years, I suppose, maybe, but it seems there's still that reluctance to book big events.
And there is, and it's kind of understandable, and so much of it naturally is going to be directed by local governments as to what they allow and what they will not. But I certainly am seeing some green shoots, shall we say. And I've actually now been asked to appear in person at different venues starting this fall. And I haven't done that since,
that's an encouraging sign.
Exactly. So you start to see those things happening. Now, naturally, big conventions, the booking time for those, it goes out years. So is it going to take a while? Absolutely, it will. However, I think for a lot of people now, they're just zoomed out and they are sick and tired of working at their dining tables and meeting people virtually. So it wouldn't surprise me that once we do feel comfortable, question is, when will that be? Yeah, we're going to try and get back in the groove that we were in a year and a half ago, hopefully fairly quickly.
Overall, you still feeling optimistic for Seattle's future, that downtown will come back to being the bright, shining urban mecca it once was?
I think it will. Do I think it's going to look exactly the same? No, I don't. But it's the demise of downtown, I think, as I said before, has been somewhat greatly exaggerated. We have issues, there's no doubt about it. But as businesses start to reopen, and we know a lot of companies are now already setting dates that will require their staff to come back into work, into an office, that is going to help. That's certainly going to help the downtown retail. Also going to help the bars and the restaurants and these kinds of things. But in terms of overall employment, I'm afraid that we are not going to get all of the jobs that we lost due to COVID back this year. It's going to be sometime into next year before we get to that point. So it's going to be a while to see a full recovery, but it is certainly heading the right direction.
Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner. Matthew, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure, David. Take care.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien, and we've heard you talking about them, Fauci emails. You have texted us. What about the Fauci emails? So we went right to the source, a Washington Post reporter who obtained 866 pages of emails from Dr. Anthony Fauci in April and March of last year. So really at the beginning of the pandemic. And that reporter is Yasmin Abutaleb. Welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Obviously, everybody wants the inside scoop on what was happening in the White House between President Trump and Anthony Fauci. Why these 2 months of emails, though?
Well, that was really the point where the pandemic was starting to pick up in the United States. That's when the national shutdown first went into effect in mid-March. And then in April, of course, is when you saw this Trump versus Fauci dynamic really emerge. They were standing together at a lot of these daily White House press briefings. Dr. Fauci rose to worldwide fame in that time period because he was willing to contradict the president on whether hydroxychloroquine worked, the drug that the president was pushing at the time, whether the virus was going to disappear like the president wanted, whether it was safe to reopen or not. He was the one most openly contradicting and at odds with Trump at that time. And so we thought this was the point where he was really rising in prominence. The tensions with the president were starting to become much more pronounced and exacerbated. So we wanted to see if the emails offered any new insight into that.
And what did they show you?
Well, I think Dr. Fauci's been a government employee for a long time, so he knows better than to put anything too revealing or private in email. You can tell he's very careful in these emails, probably well aware that people like us and others might request them. But you do see how much he's getting flooded with requests from everyone, from strangers, from other government employees, either within an NIH or at other agencies, from old colleagues and associates. I think it really illustrates the level of confusion there was in the country at that time, because everyone is writing him asking, can I get on a flight? Is this actually safe? Please keep standing up to the president. Please keep speaking truth to power. There are some kind of funny emails in there too. People are drawing these cartoon superhero images of him. And you don't see him directly criticize the president or anyone in the White House in these emails. You actually see him still exchanging notes with them. They're still working together. But I think it's remarkable to see just how much so much of the country was relying on one single person. And then in the same vein, I think we see now with the release of the emails, he's a hero to some people and the person that they felt they could rely on. And he's a complete villain and antichrist to another group of people. I mean, he's become this really, really polarizing figure.
Yeah. What is it about the release of the emails? Because you read and a colleague read through all of them. And that's what I see, too, from some of our listeners who think the emails prove that Fauci was up to no good. But I didn't see any of that in your reporting.
And I don't think that's reflected in the emails. BuzzFeed News obtained even more emails and put them all online on the same day that we did. They obtained about 3,600 pages of his emails. And what happened is people, I think, are often seeing these emails and jumping to conclusions without understanding the context around them. So there was one email in the pages of emails that BuzzFeed published where there's a discussion about gain of function research. And it's Dr. Fauci exchanging emails with a respected infectious disease researcher about whether the virus has any attributes of gain of function research. It turns out a couple of days after that email exchange, the researcher comes to the conclusion that no, there's no way this virus could have been engineered. This doesn't look to be indicative of gain of function email. But I think a lot of people are seizing on that and saying, see, he knew and he hid it from us when that's not the case. It was a question they were exploring and they wanted the answer to. But the widespread theory and the notion that most scientists had last year about the origins of the virus was that it jumped from an animal to humans. They always held out the possibility that it could be a lab leak, but they thought it was unlikely. But I think because of that, a lot of people are saying Fauci hid information from the public, whereas I don't think that's what that email shows.
And, you know, there are some interesting exchanges in there, too, from a military professional telling Fauci, you know, hey, I support you. Just cover your six, which means cover your back. Of course, that's going to jump out and grab you. But since you weeded through all 866 pages of these emails, what to you was the most interesting part about his email exchanges?
That's a great question. I think it was really interesting that him and George Gao, the head of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention, despite this war of words that was escalating at that time last year between President Trump and President Xi Jinping of China, where Trump was calling it the China virus and was really switching tack to blaming China for all of this and kind of trying to distract from his administration's handling of it, that these two scientists who have known each other for a long time are trying to maintain these delicate ties. They're kind of independent of the political brawl, just checking in on each other. You know, George Gao says to him, I heard that there are some threats against you. I hope this is fake and I hope that you're okay. He's trying to clear the air after an interview where he said the US was making a mistake by not having people wear masks. I thought that was really interesting. And I thought just the degree to which Dr. Fauci tried to respond to emails from people all over the world and strangers answering their questions, despite everything he was dealing with, was kind of compelling, too.
I would love to know his secret of staying so calm and so zen, because, yeah, you never see him get one way or the other, get angry or extremely. He just stays even. And I would love to know his secret. You don't hear from Fauci much these days. What is he up to?
Well, he's actually done a few interviews in the last few days about the emails, and he is, you know, very, very calm and all of that. But you can tell it's agitating, just how much speculation and conspiracy theories have kind of been swirling around the emails and what he knew when and whether he was hiding things. You can see that, you know, he feels that there is nothing incriminating in these emails, that people are taking them out of context, that it's very frustrating for him. But I think other than that, he's focused on the country's vaccination campaign, trying to build trust in the vaccine. I think there is some concern that this focus on him and what he knew and if he's hiding information does undermine trust in public health professionals and confidence in the vaccine, especially if he's the one delivering that message. But this is obviously there's much less drama for him this year in terms of his relationship with the administration. So he's not quite as front and center as the time period we were looking at last year.
Yeah, he certainly got a crash course in how to be a public figure, for sure. So, you know, 866 pages of emails. We know BuzzFeed has 3,600 pages. What are you after next?
I mean, we have to cover this administration's response and, you know, their efforts to get the country vaccinated and meet their goals. It's looking more and more difficult for President Biden to meet his July 4th vaccination goals. And of course, we're continuing to report really aggressively on the origins of the virus, what U.S. intelligence agencies and the White House do and do not know about it, how robust or not the information is, and whether there is new information to be gleaned from that. Less focused on whether there was a conspiracy to cover things up, but more just really trying to find out what does the U.S. know and not know? Are we ever going to get answers to some of these questions, and why or why not?
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. From the Washington Post, reporter Yasmin Abutaleb, appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
So after all those emails, it turns out that Dr. Fauci is exactly what he appeared to be.
Yeah.
A scientist who is trying to do his best to figure out where it came from and how to stop it.
And help people. I mean, the number of emails he responded to, even after midnight, you know, people peppering him with questions like, can I get on an airplane? He will answer that. So, you know, I suppose the journalists will keep digging. But so far, yeah, he is as he appears.
I mean, that's their job to dig through it. But you know, the agenda for some of them was to find some sort of smoking gun somewhere where he was in a lab with his Chinese counterpart cooking up a virus to unleash on the world.
So he could be on the cover of Vogue.
Yeah, like he cares about that. Choke points.
Let's go.
Every summer, the paving and chip seal crews descend on the roads, and maybe you've wondered, how do they decide which roads to fix? And Chris is here with how Snohomish County does it.
Snohomish County has 1,600 miles of roads to maintain. They're a combination of major arterials and smaller residential roads. Every year, the Public Works Department hires a rating contractor to go out and rate the roads. The county combines that information with its own observations and decides which roads need to be at the top of the list. Jim Parker is the road maintenance director for Snohomish County Public Works. Here's what he's looking for.
Cracks along the edge of the road, that's called alligatoring. Of course, any kind of frequent or major potholes, things like unraveling of materials that were put down previously. We also take a look at, you know, what's going on with the subgrade on the shoulders and around the road itself.
Once they prioritize the roads, Parker and his staff have to decide how to repair them. Are the lanes bad enough that they need to be ground down and replaced with a new layer, or can they get by with chip sealing them? Chip sealing uses a thin layer of asphalt with a lot of small rocks or aggregate in the mix. It costs about a third of repaving and could give the county 7 to 10 more years of life.
We're going to be resurfacing 27 routes, and that's going to be about 81 miles of chip sealing and 7 miles of repaving.
The roads around Snohomish, Sultan, and Granite Falls are going to see the largest amount of work this year. Snohomish County residents received a pamphlet in the mail earlier this year to tell them when and where to expect the work. You can also find that at MyNorthwest.com. Parker says they also put out a warning a couple of weeks ahead of time.
We'll put out signs about 1 to 2 weeks before we start the work, and we'll give an idea of exactly, you know, where the start and the stop points are for the work so folks can kind of plan ahead.
This work is also weather dependent, so the work can sort of be a moving target. Parker says maintaining the roads is the biggest line item in the budget, and he takes it seriously.
Snohomish County has a pretty good history of keeping our roads maintained. You know, we get a lot of support from our citizens, and it's obviously one of our most important programs. We put a lot of time and effort into it, and I think it's well worth the effort.
You could expect this repair work to continue through September.
So whatever happened to my brilliant idea of self-healing concrete, Chris?
God, I remember we did. There were some people that were working with that, I think, in Europe. And I think there is people, the things that they're working on, that a different type of material that allows
where
it to kind of
when it rains, the water actually combines with something in the mix to seal up
right.
The cracks.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm not sure how I'll check on that, see what I can find out if that's moved down the field at all. But I remember looking at that as something that people were trying to figure out. Yeah. Self-healing concrete. That would be tremendous because of the amount of rain we get here and the potholes and just the traffic just does a number on our roads.
If
you
could breed
a
new kind of bacteria that's able to secrete concrete as it grows.
Well, you know, why not? There are sulfur-eating bacteria that live
exactly.
in the ocean next to those volcanic outflows. So why not? I mean, there are probably plenty of things we haven't found at the deep of the ocean that could probably help us out in a lot of different ways. Sealing concrete might be one of them.
Exactly. What about that highway project you brought up last week? I've already forgotten what it was.
It was a choke point, the one through JBLM I talked about Thursday, yes, how we were going to have that new shared exit lane between Thorn Lane and Berkeley. That was supposed to open Sunday morning. That was weather dependent because they had to do a little bit of paving, but primarily some striping. That was put off because, as you know, the rain we got on Saturday into Sunday was actually kind of significant. So they're looking to put that off to this weekend. The weather forecast for this weekend isn't exactly ideal, so we're going to wait and see if they can get this thing done. That was the project that would really eliminate all that weaving and merging on southbound 5 through JBLM. So hopefully they'll get it done this weekend, and drivers there won't have to wait too much longer to get this done.
Long term, have you looked into which projects would finally get the money they need, assuming this big infrastructure package gets passed, what the priorities are would be there?
Are we talking the federal package or the state?
I'm talking about the federal package at this point. I'm talking about the interstates. I'm talking about I-5, which just seems to be getting worse and worse.
We're starting to see some wish lists and lists being put together on that. I haven't delved into that one because I've been working too deeply trying to figure out what's happening with the state transportation budget and the kind of the maneuvering that's going on there between the governor and the legislature. But I'll take a look at that too to see. I mean, certainly the Ship Canal Bridge should be on there. Probably the bridge between the Columbia over the Columbia between Vancouver and North Portland would probably be on there. So we'll see. But there's also, you know, certainly this administration and the Pete Buttigieg there at the head of transportation, big fans of light rail and, you know, public transit too. So we'd probably see a lot thrown into that, which would be great news for Sound Transit, considering the financial trouble that they have now pulling out of the pandemic.
And how long until the Puyallup River Bridge project is finally done?
Well, that's interesting. I'm sitting down with Roger Millar and the head of the project, Lisa Hodgson, later this morning. They're giving us an update on where we are with that, because obviously the funding that comes from Olympia and whatnot, we're a long time away from actually breaking ground and working on extending 167. They are still doing a ton of work there right around the Port of Tacoma, 70th over Fife, working on that overpass and the roundabout there. So there's work being done, but it's going to be a while before we finish 167. Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of that's dependent on the money.
And what's the vision? I mean, this has been going on for, you told me at one point, but I forgot. How many years has this been going on?
Well, if you think about it, the freeway just ended, in the late 80s or the early 90s when they just decided to stop it at Puyallup. They ran out of money and didn't go any further. So the scope of this is basically to run 167 there from where it ends in Puyallup, a dedicated freeway that goes all the way to I-5, basically crossing the freeway around 70th or just after it there into the Port of Tacoma. But that's going to be a toll road, most likely. And they're going to extend the hot lanes all the way down as well and make that a legit freeway that continues all the way from Auburn, basically into the Port of Tacoma there to I-5. So that will give us a full length, which would basically mean Highway 18 would become very, very quiet because people wouldn't have to come up or down the hill there, and that would put all that truck traffic on a freeway and there. So, but we're years away from that. But I'm getting an update on that later this morning.
All right. Look forward to that.
Time for your daily dose of kindness. It's brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A Southern California couple decided to make generous donations to spread joy and kindness to new families. They were very specific about how they delivered those donations to. KABC-TV's Ashley Mackey has their story.
Crystal and Patrick Duhaney decided to pay it forward by leaving cash in baby products at local Target stores.
My husband and I, you know, when we had our first child after we recently got married, we struggled to make ends meet, just like most new parents, I think.
Duhaney, a mother of two, a registered nurse, and founder of Milky Mama, a company that provides breastfeeding support to parents all over the world, posted a video on her Instagram account of her inserting money into diaper boxes and formula cans.
We really wanted to make things a little easier, hopefully brighten their day, and hopefully inspire others to kind of, you know, spread joy and kindness.
Duhaney and her husband went to various Targets. In total, Duhaney left about $1,000 in cash at the various stores.
As parents raising two young children, it's really important for us to let our children know that, you know, kindness matters and that you never know what somebody's going through.
And my hope is that whoever found a $20 bill in their formula can spent it on themselves. Moms and dads need that.
Now, from the G and Ursula Show, which begins at 9 o'clock here on Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott. Have you been following the Democrats' attempt to standardize voting across the states? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that lately, I think the Democrats have been just sitting on their heels, if you will. They've been doing too much relaxing, and who would have known that the Democrats would be in power? The president of the United States have in charge of the House and everything, and it just seems like they're just sitting back doing nothing right now. It just feels like I'm watching a football game and one team is running the ball all the way down the field.
You're talking about the Republicans now?
Yes, I am.
And what do you think they claim? When this first started back in April, they pointed to Delaware's election laws, which have some pretty strange and archaic restrictions, and saying that what they're actually doing in this election law reform is adding to the opportunities to vote while at the same time protecting the sanctity of the ballot box.
Through what, though? What are they protecting? I just don't understand how anybody could support these rules in a democracy, anything to make voting harder. What's their reason?
Well, they say it's to make sure that somebody isn't sitting there with a printing press printing phony Biden ballots and stuffing them in ballot boxes.
Yeah. I mean, I remember one time, this is random, but I remember a Little League baseball game when we played him, and he's still my buddy to this day. And we played against the Phillies, and they had a new baseball player. And it's my buddy who today, his name is Keith. And he comes out there and you could hear the parents. You could hear us like, that kid isn't 11 years old. We need to see his birth certificate, right?
Weird.
I mean, you've had that said before. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking, Keith was unbelievable. I mean, striking everybody out. And we lost the game. No question. But the reason we lost is because what do we think? They cheated, mm-hmm. right? We thought that was the reason why they won.
Anyways, well, that has happened, though, in the league in the past, has it not?
No doubt about it. Yeah. There has been cheating. There has been cheating since the world has been created. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the reason why we lost the game, because Keith was, no, they didn't cheat. He wasn't cheating in that situation. And the same thing when it comes with this voting thing. And this, I think I'm naive that I didn't see the setup in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Before the election, just the way the seeds were planted into those to believe that there's just going to be some cheating. And
okay, but why should this discourage people? What we're being told, this is going to keep Democrats from voting, basically. If that was the agenda, if you were a Democrat, wouldn't you redouble your efforts to comply with every jot and tittle of these rules to make sure that you were not disqualified from voting?
Yes, you would. But you want to talk about reasons why some don't vote. I was reading something about a few weeks ago. One of the biggest things is when you start talking about age, gender, education, socioeconomic status, and those things, one of the barriers that tend to get in the way are people that live in poverty. And according to the U.S. Census, found that 47% of eligible citizens with household incomes of less than $20,000 didn't $20,000 a year, that is, didn't vote in the 2012 election. Mm-hmm. So the reason why I bring that stat up is to say this. There are some people that's like, I don't want to. It doesn't matter if I vote. My life is going to stay the same. And so you tend to, those are in rural areas and poor neighborhoods and everything. They tend to just be like, yo, it doesn't matter who's in office, Democrat, Republican, don't matter. My life is going to continue to stay the same. And one last thing, speaking of voting, you know what would be interesting is that they made voting a little bit easier. Do you know that the United States of America is the only place where voting happens on a Tuesday?
Yeah.
Easy in Washington State, though. I mean, wouldn't you say? We have a very easy system. It gets sent to us. We don't have to pay postage. All we have to do is find a mailbox or a ballot drop box.
Colleen, I brag about Washington voting all the time.
It's good stuff.
The fact that
I
the
see
entire...
You,
Kim Wyman, I see you. The fact that we don't have that all over the country is unbelievable. But
that's what you're saying. Just take Washington.
Yeah, but back to people saying that they don't think their vote counts. Mm-hmm. If... If that's what they really believe, then they're going to, that means they don't care who runs the country. So I guess if you've given up, then it doesn't matter. I mean, what I learned when I ran was that if you don't vote, you might as well be dead because the politicians do not care about you, period.
Yeah, but Dave, I hear what you're saying. I totally do. But I'm telling you, when there's people in this country, and which there are a lot of people in this country, that's like, no matter what I do, my life isn't changing.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes this is the time that some of us have to just try to look at it from their point of view and how they're looking at it. Like, they're like, wait a minute, nothing changes. I mean, I look at President Joe Biden, who's, yeah, you know, President Joe Biden, he talked that talk today. But Joe Biden, that ain't how you used to talk back in the 80s. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, hey, I have memories. So some of these same folks, Democrat, Republican, some of you guys all got some slick willy ways and you've been padding your pockets. You see what I'm saying? So you at one moment you could say, yes, I agree with you, Dave. Mm-hmm. Hey, you want to change? You want to impact the world? You want to have more change in this world? You got to vote. Yes, you and I know that for sure. But there's some people out there that's like, man, I don't care what you say. My life ain't changed. My mama's life ain't changed. My daddy's life ain't changed. Ain't nothing changed. And it doesn't matter who's in office. So that's why they get negative when it comes to exercising their vote.
Okay. But the consequence of that is it won't matter who's in office because the people whose lives are benefited by politics will vote and they will get their way. And those whose lives are not being helped by politics will not get their way.
And then one last thing. Yeah, you got a lot of folks don't see themselves. They don't see representation, Dave. They've never seen that in their lifetime. Like, I mean, yeah, we had Barack Obama, he was president. Come on now. I mean, yeah, he was president, but there's way more to that and underneath the president of the United States than just that office right there.
G. Scott with Good Ursula, stuff. 9 o'clock on Cairo. Thanks, G. And Tuesday mornings, we go live to Washington, D.C., and Pulitzer Prize winning Washington Post reporter David Farenthold, who is originally from Houston, Texas, and who is therefore an expert in anything having to do with Texas. And I wanted to ask you about the status of election reform there. Where does it stand now? Because the governor was about to, the legislature was about to pass this bill. The governor's going to sign it, which a lot of people think is just designed to restrict Democratic votes. But then all the Democrats walked out, and what happened?
Well, they walked out and it killed the bill, at least for now. There was a timeline. The legislative session had to end, and the Democrats, by walking out, denied the Republicans a quorum, so they couldn't pass anything for the last couple hours of the session.
Okay, so now, things stay as they are. Does that mean there's more access or less access? Because I thought that the reform actually did expand at least some of the number of ballot drop boxes in the more remote areas.
It did. It expanded some drop boxes in places where a lot of Republicans live. In places like Harris County, which is Houston, where I'm from, that would have really restricted the ability of local authorities to put out drop boxes. It would have started Sunday voting at 1 o'clock instead of at 11 o'clock, which was apparently designed to keep the Souls to the Polls programs for black churches from working as well. Mm-hmm. It would have done a lot of things basically to depress the Democratic vote in big cities. So the Democrats walked out. It could still come up again. The governor is expected to call a special session later in the year. He was all ready to deal with redistricting, so he could add it to that. But it means if it comes up, it'll come up in a few months, likely, after this initial wave of momentum for Republicans has died down.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are the other more controversial provisions? I heard about Souls to the Polls. There was something about purging names from people who don't vote every year.
That's happened in a couple of other Republican-controlled states, yes. They want to make it harder, or sort of faster, for your voter expiration or voter registration to expire if you don't use it. If you don't vote, it can expire after some period of time. I think with the idea that if you come back to try to vote later, that you'll find that it's expired and either you get discouraged and leave or you don't have enough time to register before that particular election.
Yeah, but that would apply to all voters, regardless of party. So you'd be purging non-voting Republicans too, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's one of the weird things about this is the way the Republicans have gone after this is designed as if they still have the same voting base they always did, which was reliable suburbanites. You know, that's why Republicans were always thought to have done better in midterms, because their people vote more often. But the Trump coalition is different. The Trump has drawn out a lot of people who don't vote in midterms, who don't vote very often. They'll vote only for him. And so if, I think that's the idea, is that they're going to make it harder to vote, and so only Republicans will vote. But there's a lot of Trump voters who might be hit by this as well. You're right.
Do you think this could be, this could backfire?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, in a lot of these Republican states, Florida is another one. Republicans, in trying to attack what Democrats did in 2020, which was an election totally rearranged by COVID, have attacked things like vote by mail or early voting that traditionally Republicans did in the past. And so, you know, they're fighting the last war in that situation. But they're also, you know, I think presupposing that their voters are the ones who will jump through more hoops, who will have voter ID, who will, you know, who will sort of, you know, be more in touch with the bureaucracy, and so therefore more able to navigate the system. But again, Trump voters are often people who don't vote very often, and they may get snagged by this stuff too if Trump's the one who runs in 2024.
Yeah. Joe Manchin apparently is now the most powerful man in the country. I can't keep track of all the things that he is holding up, but I am surprised that he wouldn't be just gung-ho for infrastructure. I'm sort of a regular visitor to his state because I have a daughter there. And if any state needs infrastructure, it is West Virginia. So what's going on?
You're right. You're totally right. West Virginia is a state that has traditionally benefited. It's got, you know, needs a lot of infrastructure, and it's gotten a lot of it. Think about Robert Byrd, the senator from West Virginia. Everything that state's named after him because he got so much infrastructure for him. Manchin is somebody who really believes in bipartisanship, or says he does, and says he won't vote for anything, you know, unless he can get some Republican help. That's going to be hard for Biden to try to get this infrastructure bill passed. If he needs to do it through reconciliation, this method where you can, you know, pass a bill with only 51 votes, he needs Manchin. And Manchin says he wants there to be 60 votes. What I don't know is, you know, is Manchin doing this all to establish his bona fides so that at some point down the road this year he can say, like, look, I gave Republicans every chance. Nobody was more solicitous of than I am, but they didn't go for it. They're being recalcitrant. We got to go, you know, so I'm going to change my mind and vote in this one case. That's possible. It's possible he'll stick to his guns and maybe get some Republican buy-in, or maybe that he'll just stop the Democrats from doing anything. But you're right that he is, because he's the 50th vote. He's one of the most powerful people in Washington, and kind of how the way he wants this to play out is probably the way it's going to play out.
I see. And so you think that there's a possibility he is positioning himself to be able to provide cover for Democrats to be able to say, okay, we tried, but since they wouldn't play ball, we had to just pass it ourselves.
He's a bit of a mysterious person, so I can't tell you for sure it's what he's trying to do. I just feel like he has so much power by being the 50th vote. And if he goes around and insists there needs to be 60 votes for anything to happen, then he removes his own power. He removes all his own leverage. So I think, you know, there is a chance, I think, that he will eventually say, well, I gave Republicans every chance. Let's do it with 50 votes. And then he holds the key. And so then West Virginia gets twice as much infrastructure money as they would have otherwise.
Well, yeah, that's what used to work. So why not? Okay, settle a few arguments here, as I usually ask you to do. The Senate just released its investigation of what happened on January 6th. How is that any different than the commission that the House voted for?
You know, I have to admit, I was surprised by that, too. We've been writing all these stories, and I've been reading all these stories about how there's going to be no commission, no one's going to learn anything because the Republicans blocked it. And then today, we had a story saying that bipartisan Senate commission had actually learned a lot about January 6th. And particularly, they said that the police, the Capitol Police, should have known months in advance this was going to happen. Which, you know, anybody could have told you that, but they sort of wrote it down on official paper. So I guess there is some investigation going on. I'm a little perplexed myself. I think the Democrats are going to end up doing a select committee, which they have the power to do in the House, like the Republicans did with Benghazi, and making sort of a public show of investigating it. To be honest, I think the Democrats see a political advantage in doing that as late as possible, so it bleeds into the 2022 cycle. So while they're mad about there being no bipartisan committee, I think they'd be happy to do a partisan committee next year.
Okay, Trump gave a little speech, I guess it was in North Carolina. I don't know how big the crowd was. The musical selection was pretty interesting. Is this then the kickoff of the comeback, or was it just a one-off?
I've read it covered as sort of the start of a more public period for him. So he spoke to the state Republican convention in North Carolina. He supposedly is going to do some rallies this month, but I haven't seen any actual, you know, details about when and where. So yes, I think he is going to do more. He's at Bedminster now, which is not as much of a fun place as Mar-a-Lago is for him. For one thing, it's closed on Mondays and Tuesdays, so there aren't people to hang around and commiserate with. So I do think he will get out more.
That's what this is about, hanging out and commiserating?
Supposedly the White House aides, and when he was president, hated when he was at Bedminster because he would get so lonely. Mondays and Tuesdays, The club is closed for like tournaments. Charities can rent it for tournaments. Mm-hmm. And so none of his buddies are around. And that makes him sort of antsy. And sometimes he would say and do crazy things as president of Bedminster just because he wanted some attention. So that I think there's some thought that that logic may play into him being more active this year.
Well, how does he occupy his time these days? Is he sort of like OJ actively searching for the culprit who stole the election? Or what is he doing?
Well, on Mondays and Tuesdays now, he goes into New York. He goes into Trump Tower. And I think he actually does some work on his business. We're trying to figure out exactly what. But I think mostly what he does is what he did as president. Calls, watches TV, calls people on the phone. And I think now mostly commiserates about his election loss, which he still is sore over, and about the investigations, including the grand jury in New York that's looking into his business.
Yeah. When do we hear more about that?
That's what I'm working on today. It seems like they are focused on building sort of from the bottom up. So apparently the grand jury took testimony the other day from the guy who's the controller of the Trump Organization, Jeffrey McConney. The next level up is the CFO of the Trump Organization, Alan Weisselberg, who's under a lot of pressure from the DA. So, you know, it seems like they are starting kind of at the bottom of their finances and building up. I don't know when we'll see any indictments. It may be months, but they're certainly working on it. And they certainly seem to think they have a case that they can build.
David Farenthold, live from the Washington Post. David, thank you. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
During this past session, policing and COVID got a lot of the legislature's attention. But lawmakers also passed several bills that were aimed at improving the state's behavioral health system. And with a first look, here's Hannah Scott. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, so from alternatives to jail for the mentally ill to tackling the needs of our state's retooled drug possession law, state lawmakers gave a lot of attention and funding to Washington's behavioral health system. Washington is moving into the second half of Governor Inslee's five-year plan to shift our mental health response away from places like Eastern and Western state hospitals to regional community hubs being set up for a more localized approach, which should help, among other things, address things like prolific offenders who cycle in and out of jail because of breakdowns in getting them and keeping them into the system and treatment. Now, many of the bills passed by lawmakers requiring an implementation period and collaboration between state agencies. And a lot of that work right now is being landing at the feet of the state health care authority. It will be another couple of years before the vision of the governor's plan is completely recognized. So in the meantime, more changes this session could help, including the passage of the mental health sentencing alternative. Kerry Waterlin with the state health care authority, which along with the corrections department is tasked with implementing that program, which allows for the imposition of a term of community custody and treatment in place of confinement for certain defendants diagnosed with serious mental illness.
This is the mental health sentencing alternative. So someone has to have a diagnosis of a serious mental illness. But this is kind of like the companion or sister of the already existing drug offender sentencing alternative. And so there already exists a sentencing alternative for an individual who has a substance abuse or substance use disorder diagnosis. And so this is that new introduction that is specific to the mental health side of the house. So you're absolutely right. We typically have in Washington really started getting folks used to saying behavioral health. And this one kind of re-teases that back out to offer a mental health sentencing alternative that really partners well with the dose of the drug offender sentencing alternative.
Now, the big win from this would be that it would take a lot of that pressure off some of those state hospitals, Western State, Eastern State, and a lot of Eastern State beds are actually being taken away because of various bills and things that were changed in this last past session as well. Jason McGill is the assistant director at HCA, and he says they're also tasked with several duties related to the state's change in drug possession law that also leans more into treatment than incarceration. That, of course, a result of the state Supreme Court's Blake decision.
$25 million in state fiscal year 22 and $20 million in fiscal 23 to stand up a recovery navigator program. And this is through our behavioral health administrative service organization. So regionally across the state, we'll have 10 recovery navigator administrators, if you will, that will create regional plans. And then they will hire these navigators who will follow something similar to what the LEAD program's about in terms of a place to have law enforcement or others, many others, refer to these navigators and then have them help people access treatment or access recovery or meet them where they are and try to give them the supports that they need to lead a healthier lifestyle.
So that the Navigator program and then also with that mental health sentencing alternative, some of the key things that are going to happen with those when they're all up and running is you're going to have this person, a navigator or whatever other title that they might have, be a walk this person through this treatment, right? Walk them through and then come
and
out.
This will be
side.
Available on demand.
This will be available on demand. The treatment for the Blake decision, yes. And then the mental health sentencing alternative, yes. That would be something that is a diversion type of thing. A couple of other really important things that happen is more expansion of Medicaid. That means that you're getting all these folks on Medicaid so that they can get this treatment, and it takes that whole insurance issue out of the equation. They're also expanding the use of things like Suboxone and treatment in jails, and really, really focusing in on reentry services. So people who are serving time, when they get out, having someone to do that wraparound services with them, walk them through instead of just opening the door and letting them out on the street where it always doesn't go that well.
Right. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.